What is happening, everyone? Coach Ishak with HockFit Coaching and Legion Athletics, and your host for today's episode of Anabolic Radio. I'm joined today by Dasha. I don't know how to pronounce your last name, so I don't want to go. I don't want to go say something incorrectly. But she's the owner and head coach of Dasha Fit. How are you doing today, Dasha?
I'm doing well, thanks. And it's a ghoul neck. You can think of it as like a ghoul during Halloween or something.
A ghoul during Halloween. A ghoul deck. Okay. A ghoul deck.
With no D. There's no dicks involved. Sorry.
Okay, for sure. Okay, so for those of you listening, in this episode, we're going to be diving into understanding the gut and the importance of proper digestive health and its foundational role in regards to just overall progress and general health. And personally, so one of the reasons why I wanted to get Dasha on for this episode is because I've heard through similar friends that, and I've seen on her content that she's focused and more geared towards gut health and everything related to the gut. And I feel like the gut is just a foundation in regards to everything we do, right? We need it in order to digest our foods properly, in order to assimilate nutrients properly. And I feel like many of the nutritional strategies today are taken out of context. For example, like there are benefits in utilizing protocols like fasting or, for example, carbohydrate restriction. And those strategies can be implemented not only in a protocol, not only like when you're in a calorie restricted state, but they could be used to optimize things like digestive health and allow our digestive system to absorb and assimilate nutrients more effectively. And, you know, without further ado, Dasha, we'd love to hear from you in regards to this topic. Why don't you give us a little backstory in regards to how you got into this, and maybe we could break off into some cool stuff from there.
Absolutely. And I love that you mentioned the fact that there are strategies and protocols that you can use, because I think right now what I've been seeing a lot on social media is like black and white kind of regards to gut health. Like you either have people juicing and doing celery juice cleanses, and you also have researchers who are saying like, no, we don't need any of this. This isn't proven by science specifically, so there's really no validation to it. And I think that in terms of moving forward for people or coaches specifically, we need to take more of a holistic approach to this. We need to think about what we've been seeing in clinical, like sure, a case study may not be validating some sort of protocol. However, one person, that is something to add to it, you know? So I think you have to incorporate a lot of what you see. I'm not one to have that black and white thinking. I think that you can go too far off and you can become doing like food sensitivity testing unnecessarily, which has not been proven. I would not recommend, but you can also kind of understand and appreciate that, you know, maybe it did work for someone for whatever reason. And we can go into why I personally think that those reasons may be later on. But anyways, I really appreciate you touching upon that topic. Let me go into my background. So I am a nutrition researcher and currently a dietetic intern at the VA hospital down here in Tampa, completing my internship, as I said, to become a registered dietitian. I graduated with my master's in nutritional epidemiology from Tufts University in Boston and wanted to add this accreditation to my portfolio. So that's where I headed next. And so once I graduate in June, I'll be heading hopefully towards more of industry and research work. And I'm really fascinated by food industry and how we can optimize certain ingredients for the body and formulations. So
Awesome. Well, June is coming up real soon. So congratulations if I don't talk to you by then. And I'm looking forward to seeing everything that you come out with over the years. And so one of the biggest complaints I get from people is things like, bloating or heartburn, indigestion, constipation. More often than not, like most of these issues are improperly addressed by, you know, just being told to take a supplement or medication with something, when like the reality is like a lot of people are more geared towards that quick fix rather than a lifestyle change, right? Rather than, you know, proper education about the nutrients they're consuming and how they could optimize their nutrition in a way to improve their digestive health, right? And a lot of things are, like I said, you know, they're taken out of context. So if you go through a course of antibiotics, the most common thought process after finishing antibiotic therapy is, okay, I need a supplement with a probiotic right after. When what's really starting to show is that it may actually take you longer to recover microbiome status. And most of what we encounter with like a lot of people could be easily remedied and supported with just simple lifestyle changes, but being more aware of like the mechanisms and what's actually occurring in the body is also super important, which is why I wanted to get you on this episode.
So I guess one of the reasons why you said you had wanted to have me on was because of my background in celiac disease and what got me started into gut health in general. I was diagnosed with celiac disease about, 2 years ago now. I can go into my symptoms and everything, but basically I was having horrendous pains, stabbing that would leave me on the floor. I thought I had to call 911. I thought my gut was ripping open. Like, it was excruciating. So I got blood work done. And what I'm about to say, the steps in order to diagnose someone with celiac disease, this is the gold standard of testing. So if you think that you have celiac disease, this is basically what you would go through as well. So initially I got blood work done. My blood work was weird. It came back half positive, half negative. So my doctor was like, you know what, let's do an endoscopy. And so they did an endoscopy and they saw that it had half positive, half negative again. So they were like, you know what, let's do more biopsies. And so then they came back half positive, half negative again. And he was like, you know what? I think I just caught it early. So you're diagnosed and stay away from gluten. And then you can retest it if you want after, I believe he said 6 months initially. And I didn't test it on purpose, but if I became so sensitive to gluten at that point that I had been cross-contaminated a few times to the point where I could immediately notice that even if someone used like fish sauce or something, soy sauce in a dish, initially I realized it was because my aunt had cooked us dinner and she used soy sauce in the vegetable dish that she made. And I didn't realize, but halfway through dinner, I had to excuse myself. And that's when I knew that, yep, I think I do have celiac disease. Mm-hmm. But celiac disease in general is a genetic autoimmune disorder, and it only affects 1% of people worldwide. Oftentimes I see people thinking that they need to avoid gluten for some reason. That is not the case. This number could be larger, in fact, due to increased testing protocols that we've now discovered. And that's why this number might be rising. Some people say that the number is rising because of how poorly our systems are doing in terms of creating the wheat and gluten that's in our food system. But I don't necessarily know that there's evidence to support that at this point. Basically, if you do have celiac disease, you have to avoid wheat, rye, barley, malt, or anything that can be cross-contaminated, which I personally find to be true with oats. So although oats are inherently gluten-free, they're often cross-contaminated and you may react to them if you are have the celiac disease.
Mm.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. So what sort of tips do you have for people in regards to better managing, their symptoms or, let's say for example, how they could, go about selecting foods that will not, you know, sort of trigger them in certain ways?
In terms of those with celiac disease or those in general for the general population?
For celiac disease specifically.
So for celiac disease specifically, let me back up a bit. So the gut is basically lined with these villi. They're these long finger-like projections that extend. In someone with celiac disease, they're usually damaged, they're shortened, and as a result, we can't really absorb nutrients as well. That also leads to the similarity of gastrointestinal symptoms. So when you're looking in terms of celiac disease of things that'll decrease digestive burden, first and foremost, the only thing that you really can do is avoid gluten. And I mentioned earlier the products that have those in them, but another very, very closely linked to celiac disease is lactose intolerance. I believe it's, there are percentages available online about specifically how likely you are to have lactose intolerance if you already have celiac disease, but it's pretty, pretty high. So most likely if you have celiac disease, you may want to avoid dairy as well, but again, it depends on the person.
Yeah, for sure. So when we are looking at things like lectins and phytates and nightshades, these sort of compounds, how much do they potentially contribute to the slowing away of the mucosal membrane in our digestive tract?
So those are different than celiac disease. So celiac disease is an autoimmune, so it's more of an autoimmune response. When you talk about histamines and things like that, that's a non-autoimmune mediated response and reaction of the body. Not everyone is going to react to them in a certain way, right? So let's talk about, for example, theobromine, which is also found in things like chocolate and things like that. When people, for example, report that after they have chocolate, they can't sleep all night or they have an intolerance to that. It all has to do with your genetics at that point in terms of how you can digest theobromine or caffeine, things like that.
Expensive when you think about it, how many variables contribute to this, especially when it comes to what you consume. So do you have any, let's say, tips off the top of your head for people in regards to improving like their proprioceptive awareness with their digestion?
Absolutely. First and foremost, the number one thing that you can do is start to food journal. I can't tell you how helpful it is to food journal. But my number one recommendation actually, which differs from the general public. So the general population, I would say food journal, that's it. For those in the fitness industry, what I've found is that food journaling may actually, they psychoanalyze it. So I feel like people almost create their own symptoms sometimes by psychoanalyzing their own diet instead of stepping back and realizing that it's very, very simple to eat well at the end of the day, right? Focus on whole grains, fruits and vegetables, lean meats, fish, healthy fat sources.
Minimally processed foods.
Right, right. And then for some reason, we psychoanalyze all these things and then we start adding in, like you mentioned, the histamine intolerances. Oh, is it the spinach that I'm eating? Is it the strawberries? And ultimately, is it really that? Or is it the pre-workout that you're taking every single day? Is it the coffee that you're taking that stimulates you and the caffeic acid is upsetting your stomach and the acid is causing indigestion? You know, so I don't know. I find in the fitness industry, it's almost borderline psychoanalysis of the food journal, whereas
super neurotic.
You really have to stay objective. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You have to stay really objective with your food journal and step back and realize, like, is it the food that I'm eating or is it all of these other stressors in my life? Is it the fact that I'm have really high cortisol from pushing myself in training when I have no sleep at all, when I'm stressed from work all day, when I have all these other things running through my mind that are contributing to the gut. And we can talk about that too, because stress in the gut from the gut brain axis is very, very important. And great, modulates the cytokines and inflammation in the stomach. So
yeah, for sure. Great points. So for those of you who are listening, you know, digestive health is actually one of the foundations that I love talking about in regards to just generally optimizing your general health, right? So if you optimize your general health, it's going to make it much easier for you to get from point A to point B when you could potentially be making subpar progress, not sleeping properly, you know, not taking care of your digestive health, consuming a sufficient amount of fiber, phytonutrients. You know, these things are important. And although they may seem like minutiae, they do contribute to your ability to progress in the big picture of things. And we briefly touched on stress. So when we're in excessively stressed states, more so sympathetically overdriven state, our body will tend to stop producing things like CCK, like less bile production, less pancreatic enzyme production, which leads to ultimately like less breakdown and assimilation of the things you're consuming. Do you sort of want to expand from here in regards to how much stress and being in a sympathetically overdriven state impacts our ability to digest things properly?
Absolutely. I can add on to that, because you touched upon a really great point, but I think that there are other things that that leads to, right? So for example, when you're stressed, how are you eating? Are you sitting down at mealtimes, or are you scarfing down food and swallowing down air while you're eating? That's causing more bloating and gas to be released while you're digesting food. Are you chronically in, so you touched upon, for example, being in a sympathetic state. So are you constantly being driven to thus eat more or eat less as a result, because those satiety and those hunger cues are now leptin and ghrelin are being distorted. And as a result, are you chronically under eating? Are you chronically dieting for a show? And that in itself could also slow mobility of the GI tract, cause constipation. Are you drinking enough fluid? Because as an athlete, we're constantly sweating. And are you replenishing your electrolytes that can thus cause peristalsis more?
Great points. Guys, so if you don't know what ghrelin is, just considered as your hunger hormone, but it has other purposes in regards to like stimulating our stomach stimulating our stomach to produce gastric juices. So Dasha, let me ask you, how much does stress or stress hormones, things like catecholamines, influence increased gut permeability, or that quote unquote leaky gut? And how much does our immune system play a role in response to that?
I'm glad you talked about and mentioned leaky gut. So leaky gut is basically the term for increased permeability of the gut membrane that compromises the barrier function of the digestive tract. So as the lining becomes more porous, more nutrients and toxins seep into the bloodstream, and these materials are transported typically to the liver, where they detoxified and are removed from our bodies via that pathway. The unabsorbed material is an additional source of metabolic stress and increased liver burden, but that's regardless. So leaky gut is basically increased permeability. It's kind of like the marketing term for it. Dysbiosis is, on the other hand, the imbalance of good and bad bacteria within the gut. So which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is it the overgrowth of bad bacteria that's causing it to leak through the system and make the gut more permeable? Or is it the permeability that's not allowing for good bacteria to stay within the gut system and things like that? Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So a lot of things can promote leaky gut and dysbiosis. You talked about stress, which is the very, very, very high contributor. Stress hormones, birth control and antibiotics and NSAIDs and medications and alcohol, smoking, even a lack of fiber or lack of exercise, lack of sleep, infections. There's a lot of things that can promote leaky gut and or dysbiosis.
Mm. Great points. What's the course of action or management for people who are in excessively stressed states? And this is so like, this seems like an elementary question. It seems like common sense, but common sense wouldn't be so common if everyone has it. And I personally feel like how people go about managing stress is super subjective in a way, in regards to what works for one person might not work for the other, right? But let me ask you again, what are some of your top tips in regards to stress management to better optimize digestion?
Sleep first and foremost. If you can optimize your sleep, like a lot of people, they laugh at me, but I say sleep is more important than eating and exercising. Because I feel like if you don't have sleep, what's the point of a good workout? You're not going to recover from it. If you're not sleeping well, like what, can you imagine what that's impacting how you eat or what you eat throughout the day? So sleep is my number one priority. And tips on that, using a cold room. A lot of people have had success with weighted blankets. A lot of people have had success with dark rooms. So using the blackout curtains that you can buy now. Putting your phone away has been incredible. 30 minutes before even getting into bed, just put your phone literally on the other side of the room if you can, or with your computer in another room if possible, and just completely get away from that blue light, from the stimulation of what's going on in the day, and take that time instead to journal, to meditate, relax through deep breathing exercises, count up to 7 and then release to 7. Other things you can do is just get fresh air, taking walks throughout the day, massages, baths, go treat yourself to get your nails done or treat yourself to something else. But just breathing and being really, really will help.
Mm. Great points. And I feel like especially in today's era or age, like everyone is so focused on what they need to be doing, and it's just go from the second you wake up, and not many people tend to slow down and take deep breaths or do a 5-minute meditation practice or put their phones away when they're eating or be mindful of their eating or making sure they're chewing their food properly, right? Like all these things make such a huge difference on your digestive health. But I guess people are just stuck in that sympathetically driven state that they tend to forget about some of the most simplest things that make the biggest difference on everything. And inflammation and stress, like it not only impacts our gut, but it also alters our ability to utilize amino acids, for example, how like tryptophan is converted into serotonin or 5-HTP, which turns into serotonin, which turns into melatonin. Melatonin has a bunch of effects in regards to like sleep, anti-cortisol, antioxidant, all these different things. And you personally, when you were deep in the trenches during contest prep, did you notice any particular differences in regards to overall like digestive health or like your digestive system's efficiency in like burning through foods or burning through meals?
Personally, I did not, but I am a wacko weirdo case. On top of my celiac disease, I can handle a lot. My off-season diet was about 3,200 calories deepest in my bulk. And my lowest that I got to was, I think, 1,500 or 1,600 calories. And diet composition wise, I didn't really change anything in terms of food choice. I did, but it was more focused on just using things that would fill me up, like salads versus white rice and things that were really easy for me to digest, which I can also go into because I know a lot of people also suffer from choosing foods that work for them. But
Yeah. So why don't we expand off into that? And do you ever, or have you seen in your experience, or have you read something where, you know, excessively like high volume foods can contribute to a little bit of water retention?
High volume foods?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't specifically read into that. However, what I will say is if you step back and think about it from a different perspective, if you're eating a lot of volume, what makes up volume? It's constituents of the food in terms of particles in addition to water, right? So what makes it high volume? It's most of the time, like what makes a cucumber high volume to eat? It's the fact that, it's the water that's associated with it. So if you're filling up your stomach with mainly a lot of foods that are filled with waters or fibers that you might be holding the water, that would make sense to me. And the fact that if you're eating more volume, you might have a perceived conception that you're holding on to water because you feel so bloated as a result of just the sheer volume of food that's in your stomach, if that makes sense. Like you feel bloated because there's more volume in your stomach.
For sure. That makes complete sense. And I'm not particularly sure. Do you work with competition prep clients?
No.
No. Okay.
My area is more in the clinical focus, given my RD background and the research background. I think that I'm not more into the bodybuilding sector now.
But do you still have
an awareness? Yeah.
Physique-driven goals?
Me personally, right now, I don't. But I guess I do in a sense. I do want to build muscle and gain fat because I'm one of those people that struggles with digestive distress once they reach a certain caloric burden. But
So total side note. What are some of your, let's say, two go-to tips in regards to people who are in their off season or people who are in a calorie surplus and they're trying to maximize things like muscle growth, in regards to consuming that much food and keeping regular digestion?
So we talked about, for example, volume. And I will tell you that liquid calories is going to be your best friend. And a lot of people talk about liquid calories when they drink like cyclic dextrin during their workouts, for example. But you also have to be careful with things like that because they are I make up this word every single time I talk about it. I make up the term osmolalic, but they have high osmolality. And so what that means is they'll pull water into your gut and cause diarrhea basically at the end of the day. So a lot of people might struggle with that if they have a sensitive GI to it. But liquid calories otherwise are a great source. So making smoothies, shakes, high calorie shakes, very simple foods too, will do really well for the stomach. Things like honey, rice, sweet potatoes, plantains sit really well. And I found that personally, gluten-free products like gluten-free bagels are really easy for me to put down. Gluten-free breads are really easy for me to put down. But for someone else, that might be gluten-containing. But to each their own.
For sure. So, total side note, when you were peaking, for your show, I'm not sure how many shows you did. You did one or more than one?
I've done two shows in the past, but the one you're talking about probably is the most recent one I did last April.
And, for your peak, did you, let's say, for example, prioritize hypoallergenic, food selection over like hyperallergenic food selection? Cause like, let's say when, like, it's very common for people to peak, they deplete, then they go bombard their GI with things that aren't particularly the best choices, for their gut in regards to, absorption and assimilation of whatever they're consuming.
That's a great point. So actually for my peak week, I was working with a coach and I had a meal plan for my peak week. So it basically was white rice, sweet potatoes, bananas, asparagus, ground turkey, chicken, olive oil, and peanut butter. I think those are the eight sources of foods that I ate. And so every single meal I was eating those things, it was very, very easy on my GI tract. But because of the carbs increase, my carb load, I think I carb loaded like up to 500 or 600 grams of carbs a day. As I was tapering up to that, my GI started flaring. Again, just from the pure amount of food that I had to eat for my body, it just was not tolerating it very well. So it went right through me. I still haven't decided if it has to do with the carbs, the salt, the potassium, because if you think about it, bananas and sweet potatoes are pretty high in potassium. So the shift in that, I even experienced like blood pressure problems. I remember sitting in class one day and I started seeing stars for no reason.
What?
Literally. And I obviously wasn't hungry. I mean, I was carb loading 600 grams of carbs. Like I was completely full, but I just started seeing stars and I was like, what is going on? So when you see stars, it's blood pressure regulation, high or low blood pressure, but I have a feeling that something was up with the potassium, the sodium, the water that I was drinking. So just a fun fact.
Interesting fact. I guess something to consider. And if you're a celiac and you want to compete one day, you could do it because she did it. And if you put your mind to it, you can make it happen. And so you did your thesis in regards to the paleo diet. Is that right?
Paleo diet. Yeah, correct.
Paleo, paleo, potato, potato. I always mess it up how I say it. But do you want to expand off into there? And let's go ahead and get into what you wrote your thesis about.
Yeah, sure. So I wrote my thesis on fiber it was technically called Undiscovering Modern and Historic Discrepancies in the Paleo Diet. So I basically wrote out exactly how the paleo diet was started, from what research it came from, did it have any research behind it? And then what does the modern paleo diet look like? How in research settings, whether it be observational or randomized controlled trials, how they are being adapted by the participants and the amount of fiber that we're seeing. Because earlier on when they first predicted the historic paleo model, the journal writers who were Ian and Connor, they predicted that it would be 109 grams of fiber or 103 grams of fiber in a day from the paleo diet. And I looked at that and I was like,
that's a lot of fiber,
right? Like that cannot be right. That cannot be right. I don't care what you eat as a Paleolithic person, but there is just no way that is happening. So I decided to dig deeper, look at where it came from. It's actually based off of something called the Ethnographic Atlas, which is made by anthropologists and not anyone who has to do with nutrition. And what they did is they take this Ethnographic Atlas. It's a compilation of many, many civilizations throughout the world, and it just describes their patterns of eating, of fishing, of cultural practices, it's really meant for anthropologists and people who study society and behaviors, right? But for some reason, we decided to take what we know about their fishing patterns and their hunting patterns and use the coding from that atlas to extrapolate a diet for the paleo people. And that's how we came about 109 grams. It was based off of, or 103, it was based off of about, I believe it was just a handful, no more than 10 or 15 foods. I want to say closer to 6 foods that they chose to base the entire diet off of for these people, which does make sense because if you think about it, and in those times, they really only had access to a limited number of foods. Mm-hmm. But if you think about all the types of fibers too, I remember you had said that you were interested in that, but the types of fibers that they're eating also would be significantly different. Like now we have microwaves and we can cool foods and we can heat foods, which will change the type of fiber and the amount of fiber in a certain food. They didn't have that back then, but I digress. So I studied the fiber intake of the paleo diet in the historic models and then also in the modern models and how we're adopting the diet today and whether it does have those purported health benefits that they are reporting in literature. Mm.
Great points. So are you familiar with resistant starch?
Yes.
Okay. I know I briefly touched on it when we were talking back and forth, but do you want to expand on resistant starch and how it could be something that a lot of people are lacking in their diet?
Sure. So resistant starch is a soluble fiber. Resistant starch is found naturally in the plant cell walls. You can find it in things like oatmeal or legumes or
green bananas.
Yeah, unripened bananas is another good one. It can be extracted and added to a lot of processed foods as well to just boost their fiber content. And it also can be made when you heat and cool, like potatoes, for example. It'll form more resistant starches. For example, one of my favorite things to do is sweet potatoes, air fry them or bake them in the oven when you meal prep on Sunday and eat them cold throughout the week with like bananas and peanut butter, which is clearly... I ate it during prep and I loved it. So if you can do that, I think you can do anything.
I might have to try that. When I was peaking, my to-go too was sweet potato and raisins. And
yes, I love raisins.
Are so are you familiar with multiple transportable carbs? I know this is a total side note, but are any of the literature that's come out in regards to that?
Multiple transportable carbs. Can you elaborate on what that would mean?
Okay, so it basically by utilizing multiple types of carbohydrates, let's say like fructose or glucose, you're enabling your ability to utilize and assimilate more carbohydrates in a given meal.
Yeah. So I've read about that. And then I've also read about carbohydrate training for the GI for endurance athletes in order to teach their bodies how to kind of metabolize more carbohydrates. And what I can say about that is although my friend is a cross trainer who does this and he says there's no research on it or doesn't support it as much, but I believe in it in a gut bacteria standpoint because of things we know about just how we handle certain macronutrients in our diet. So for example, people always bash the keto diet because they say that the keto diet will help you increase your ability to fuel on fats. And that's completely true because whatever you feed your body's going to become more efficient in metabolizing that macronutrient source. Your best bet would be to be the most metabolically flexible, which means that you're able to metabolize fats, carbs, and proteins in equal amounts, and not stray from one to the other because you don't want to be bad at utilizing carbs ever or bad at utilizing fats ever. But by training your body to eat more carbs, I think that makes sense because the bacteria that digest the carbs in your gut will start to grow and then they'll become more efficient at digesting the carbs that you're eating.
Mm. Great points. Would you briefly, or I know we're running short on time too, but would you briefly like to touch on the second brain and how much our gut and our digestive health like influences our mood and how we're feeling?
Absolutely. So there is a lot of research on food and mood. It's because that proteins that occur in food and then the protein derived compounds, they may modulate the immune response of the body, which we know the vagus nerve is responsible for, thus transporting with the GABA, the 5-HT, the cytokines, and the cytokines thus lead to the inflammatory process, right? So in the inflammatory process, one of the things would be increased gut permeability, which may lead to thus the translocation of the food components that we're eating into the blood. And that would result in an abnormal immune response and the circulation of pro-inflammatory cytokines, not only if it's in the bloodstream, thus it's in the brain. And it could lead to the development of some sort of mood disorder.
Mm. Great points. For example, like serotonin or dopamine are two big neurotransmitters that are produced in the gut, if not mistaken. And if there's excess stress, excess inflammation, like I said earlier, you could divert tryptophan into kynurenine, which later turns into quinolinic acid, which ultimately that'll lead to memory lapses, things like brain fog, things like lack of focus. So if you suffer from those things, you may want to be a little bit more aware in regards to how you're structuring your nutrition and being a little bit smarter about your food selections. Dark chocolate, for those of you who follow my stories, and I always love structuring it around like my word blocks or before I hit the gym. Different conversation for another time. But I genuinely appreciate you coming on this episode. Do you have any things you would like the listeners to tune into for the near future, or, you know, some projects that you're currently working on?
Well, first of all, I know I mentioned food sensitivities and intolerances and allergies earlier. So if we want, we can go into that in another podcast at some point and we can keep going if you're listeners have specific questions on natural versus processed foods or types of fibers. I know there's a lot of different things that we can talk about. But yeah, so we can go into that. But also for me personally, I'm going to be in March at the Arnold.
Oh, really? I'll see you there.
Yeah. And I'll be there with, we're doing a coaches kind of workshop, and all the proceeds will be going to charity. So it's going to be a great cause. And there's a lot of cool people who will be there. Chris Bearcat, Lacey Dunn, a lot of cool coaches who will be talking about optimizing for clients and optimizing for just the general public if you're interested in learning the science behind it. So that'll be fun for anyone who wants to be interested. And then Lacey and I came out with a full gut health course and thyroid health course. So she talks about thyroid, hypothyroidism, understanding your thyroid. I mean, we go into so much about doctor's notes, meal plans, exercise plans. So if you're interested in learning about that too, we can send the link in whatever bottom. But yeah, if you have any questions, feel free to always reach out to me. I'm very open and I love helping people and talking. So we can share more information as well.
Message her, ask her all the questions. Genuinely appreciate you making time. And for those of you listening, I'll also be at the Arnold, Ohio with my supplement sponsor, Legion Athletics. And we'll be there with Chris Bearcat and
I think Legion might be helping to sponsor the talk too.
Oh, really?
We will see you there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see each other there. And thank you for everyone who tuned into this episode. If you'd like to see Dasha on a future episode, and we'll expand more on gut health and food sensitivities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, go ahead and leave a comment, like the video, or message Dasha, tag us on Instagram, and all that good jazz. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and we'll catch you in a future episode. Bye-bye.